when you do your practicum teaching the other students in teacher training, you say Trikonasana and everybody just like naturally goes into that. You don't even have to explain what that is. They already know it. And they'll even like kind of like help you because they're wanting to support you, right? And so they'll bypass if your instructions are a bit confusing. A lot of times they'll do it right anyway. So you're getting this idea of like, okay, my instructions work and people can all access these shapes. Then you get out into the real world and you're confused. Why are the same cues that I used during teacher training not working? And the same poses I used in teacher training are not working.
You're listening to the Yoga Teacher Resource Podcast. Knowledge, techniques, and inspiration for your teaching and your practice. I'm your host, Mado Hesselink. If you're a yoga teacher who loves learning, is passionate about spreading the benefits of yoga, and desires more resources to support your teaching, you're in the right place. Let's get started with today's episode.
I did a poll on Instagram, and out of the different topics we were thinking about, and teaching mixed abilities in the same class was definitely the top response. So, did you ever struggle with this?
Yeah, certainly I did. You know, as a new teacher, it's really hard to be flexible in the moment and just off the top of your head know how to accommodate someone with just different movement abilities and different experience levels. You kind of have in mind a certain sequence of postures that you're going to do, and then you kind of get thrown a curveball because actual humans show up to class and they have all these different needs. So I definitely remember being thrown off a bit in my early years of teaching and having that be a source of some stress and anxiety.
I think it's most stressful when most of your students have one type of ability level. Like, for example, I think the biggest one is easily able to get up and down off the ground. You've got a class of 10 people and 9 of them can get up and down no problem, and one of them is struggling or two of them are struggling. If there's a lot of people struggling, I think it's a bit easier, but to keep the experience going for a set of people who aren't struggling while also helping somebody who what you planned wasn't right for them, I think that is harder. I think it's harder to adapt your plan than it is to completely throw it out the window. What are the components of what yoga teachers need to know in order for this to become easier?
A few things come to mind. Number one, if we're planning for an all levels class, we really should be planning for an all levels class and expect there to be mixed abilities in the room. So go ahead and think through what are some different options for these postures that I can have on the tip of my tongue, because there are going to be some people who are going to need some variations and modifications of this. So I think that'd be just good to think through in advance so that we're not surprised by it. Aside from that, it's really, really helpful to know what joints are moving and which muscles create those movements. So if we have a posture that's doing hip extension, but we need to turn down the challenge on it, well, we need to understand what hip extension is and how to use it in some other ways.
So you're really talking about progression and regression, how to take a concept and an intention of an exercise and make it easier or harder. I think as yoga teachers, our own body is our laboratory. So that's like the starting point. And we don't really think like backwards from our body. We only think forward, what we want to accomplish in the future. And at the same time, when people come to class and they're more advanced than us, we don't really worry about them. Advanced being like physically able. They're more physically able than us. We're like, okay, well, you do your thing, right? But if they're less physically able than us, then we feel responsible. And if we don't remember what it was like, or maybe we've never experienced that, right? Because we started moving at such a young age that we don't even have a memory of not being able to do certain things. I think that's where we need a more analytical approach.
Yeah, agree. It is going to be harder to regress a movement than progress it. Because you're right, a lot of us have in mind a direction that we want to be moving in with a posture or a movement or an exercise, but we don't often do mind games about envisioning how would we back this up.
Let's talk about the different ways that someone's physical ability might be limited. The three that come to the top of my mind are strength, or stability. Those are kind of in the same world. Range of motion and body awareness, like the ability to access strength or range of motion.
I guess we could add functional mobility to that. You know, like you mentioned, the ability to get up and down off the floor. That may not be a real range of motion limitations. It actually could be a confidence limitation in a way.
So I think what you're saying is that there's maybe like a psychological component as well, where we might not have the strength, we might not have the range of motion, we might not have the body awareness, and we might not believe in ourselves or believe that we're capable of something.
Or that we feel ready to do it that day.
You were talking earlier about simplifying postures. When we've been doing yoga for a long time, we forget that even what seems like a very simple yoga posture to somebody who's been practicing for a long time is actually quite a complex movement for the average person who's going to be showing up at a yoga class, because we're talking about multiple joints moving in multiple directions with multiple loads applied to those joints. You're like, oh, warrior one, it's simple. Triangle, it's simple. And it's not simple. But if you bring it to your class as if it's simple, and then people are struggling with it, then you're going to be challenged to figure out how to help them. But if you can come with the acknowledgement, like, this is actually complicated, this is multifaceted, and here are all the different ways people might struggle with it, now we can do that planning work you were talking about earlier to break apart the poses into components and to really think through, okay, if strength is the problem, here's how I can make it easier. If range of motion is the problem, here's how we can back that out. If body awareness or the ability to coordinate the parts is the problem, here's an approach we could take.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think there's some basic biomechanical principles that are maybe missing from a lot of yoga trainings that would be incredibly foundational in understanding how to do this.
Definitely.
What are the ones that spring to mind for you?
A couple that spring to my mind. One is, let's all learn what we should expect from a normal human body in motion. So, you know, thinking back on my first yoga teacher training that you were in also, right? We learned how to label a few muscles on a diagram, and essentially that's really it. But what we did not learn that could have been a great starting point is, how much range of motion do normal shoulders have in all the different planes of movement? How much range of motion is normal for a human hip? How much external rotation should I see a hip do on a yoga mat? And without knowing those normal kind of reference points for the joints in the body, we really don't know if what we're seeing in class is a limitation or not, because we really don't know what's normal. And certainly there are going to be people in class that are within the normal range. Some of them are going to be, you know, displaying excessive range of motion, and some are going to be restricted in their range of motion. But it's really hard if we don't have that starting point to really know what we're seeing. So that's a big, big one. On top of that is going to be, what muscles are responsible for producing those movements? Now, I am kind of acting like that's simple or basic, but that takes a long time to learn. And I realize that in a lot of teacher trainings, there isn't that amount of time really that they can devote to learning this. And that's, you know, not their fault per se, but it does leave us with a deficit that makes it challenging for us to figure this out when it comes to multi-level classes.
I think another limitation of teacher trainings is the way that people with extreme ranges of motion are attracted to yoga and then attracted to teaching yoga. And this is why when you do your practicum teaching the other students in teacher training, it's very, very different from when you get out into the world and you start teaching yoga students who are not teachers or teachers in training. Because in teacher training, you say Trikonasana and everybody just like naturally goes into that. You don't even have to explain what that is. They already know it. And they'll even like kind of like help you because they're wanting to support you, right? And so they'll bypass if you're instructions are a bit confusing, a lot of times they'll do it right anyway. So you're getting this idea of like, okay, my instructions work and people can all access these shapes. And then you get out into the real world and you're confused. Why are the same cues that I used during teacher training not working? And the same poses I used in teacher training are not working for this population.
When we get out of teacher training, we really don't have that experience of teaching people who don't already know what to do, you know, unless there's been some real other practicum opportunities where you've kind of recruited people who are very new to yoga and practiced on them, which is a great thing to do. So there's one other thing too that is related to kind of joint ranges of motion, and that is understanding the difference between joint positions and muscular actions. That's where things can get really confusing. So I guess I just mentioned three sort of building blocks, which is joint range of motions, what muscles are responsible for those. And then when we're looking at a posture and we see the shape, we want to be able to recognize not only what the positions of the joints are, but which muscles are active in that posture, because those aren't always the same. The knee might be flexed, the front knee in Warrior Two, but it's the knee extensors that are active holding you there, for example. Right.
And then on top of that, you mentioned earlier the effects of gravity, which is a type of load, type of loading, where props kind of have a similar role, where they're either going to make the position more challenging or less challenging, depending on their relationship to gravity. And so gravity is super, super important. And I don't remember talking about gravity in teacher training, do you?
No, never.
There was no discussion of how to make it easier on people, really. It was really all about how to progress them and make it harder.
It really is true. And there's so much we can do to just work with gravity to turn things up or turn things down. And it's a really fabulous thing to work with in asana practice. In fact, it's all we have to work with. It's really all we have to work with. And, you know, unless we're like doing asana with stretchy bands and weights, we don't have external loads in asana practice, but we have gravity. That's what we have. Yeah.
So give us some broad brushstrokes of how we can use gravity to turn up the challenge, and then especially how we can use gravity to turn down the challenge.
Okay, so let's just take a locust posture. Now, this is just a posture that just jumped into my mind, and I'm envisioning a locust posture. So you're face down in the prone position, and you're arms are out like the shape of a cactus or a goalpost or a W, okay? And so when we would be on the ground and we lift up into this locust variation, we're lifting our legs up, we're lifting our chest and our head, and we're also lifting our arms up, and we're in that goalpost position. So this is a pretty challenging version of locust pose, I think, because we've got our shoulders in a lot of external rotation and we are against gravity, okay? So when we are lying down on our bellies, gravity is pushing us further into the ground, and now we're lifting up against gravity. So we've got some resistance, and that's challenging. So let's say we want to make it a little less challenging. Well, we could practice that shape, because we might need to practice that external rotation of our shoulders. That might be kind of new and interesting for us. We could just practice that standing up. It looks the same. We're not going to, you know, take our legs out from under ourselves, but we can just stand up with the same arm position and kind of do some upper body extension and take our arms back in that same movement. Now we've got gravity pointing straight down, but we are not moving our spine or our arms into the force of gravity. So we have eliminated gravity from that situation. Okay, that's a gravity eliminated. Gravity is working on our body, but not against this movement of upper body extension and taking my goalpost arms back. All right, so that's one place we could take it, to learn the movement without the extra load of gravity on our body. Let's just say we wanted to turn it down even more. Well, let me just lie down on my back and push, you know, to push my goalpost arms, cactus arms, into the floor behind me. Now I've got a couple things going on. Number one, I've got the feedback from the floor. I can really feel myself pushing into the floor. So I'm going to feel that the muscles activate in the back of my body. That'll be interesting. But now guess who's helping? Gravity. Gravity's helping me do this movement now. It's not resisting me. It's not eliminated. It's actually helping me. It's pulling me into the earth with it. So that's just one example.
So one challenge when we're starting to work with gravity and changing our orientation to gravity is that it's very difficult to cue a class into different orientations at the same time. So if you had some people who needed to be back down, some people who needed to be upright, and some people who were fine to be face down, how would you approach that?
Let's just all start on our backs. Let's just all dial it back and start at sort of the building blocks, because this is going to make it interesting, I think, for the whole class as far as really exploring a movement or a posture from all angles. We can all start on our backs, gravity assisted, and we could practice pushing into the floor and feeling what that feels like. We could try it standing up, maybe in our standing series of postures. And then eventually we can progress to the floor if we feel ready and comfortable in that position. And if people can get onto the floor, there may be some people that just lie on their belly, right, and experience that position without lifting up, let's say, depending on, you know, how they're feeling about that. But I do think it's worthwhile to have everybody back the posture up and then progress it from there in a building block kind of way. And I think it'll give people more of an appreciation about all the things that are going on in each posture.
Yeah, I agree. One of the biggest ways that humans miss opportunities in their movement diet is to think that just because they can do a harder version, that they should always do that harder version. And when I think about the people who are like truly, truly skilled movers, that is not how they approach movement. They are always coming back and practicing their scales in the less loaded versions. I mean, if you look at how Olympic athletes warm up, they're going to take the movements that they're going to do in their elite level sport, and they're going to do a very regressed version. They're going to do a very unloaded version a lot of times and really build that muscle memory and that connection and that coordination. And they never stop doing that. They never say, I'm too advanced for that. So I think this is like one of the biggest misconceptions that maybe some of our yoga students might have. And then even some yoga teachers have this. Oh, my students are too advanced for that. Or most of my students are too advanced for that. If we could let go of that, first of all, in our own practice, come back to the basics and regress and regress and regress and experience the benefit, the mind-body connection, the deepened nuance of our experience in these regressed positions, then we're going to be able to bring that to our class with this spark of understanding of how beneficial this is, right? Instead of being like, okay, everybody, we're going to do the easy version. And then now we get to do the hard version. I know I'm exaggerating here, but this is like the energy that a lot of people bring to the class, that the hard version is what's exciting. And it's just a missed opportunity. That's really what it is.
I agree. It's a huge missed opportunity, because the more challenging version, or what we would think of it as the more advanced version of a posture, is more challenging in some ways, but the regressed version is way more challenging in other ways that are, in my mind, gosh, kind of more interesting, you know, from like a mind-body connection standpoint and a coordination standpoint and kind of a neuromuscular, like learning some patterns and getting more subtle and nuanced. That's where that kind of magic happens, is in the less physically demanding versions. We get into that nuance. Then we can bring that with us as we progress the movement into more and more, you know, challenging arenas if we want to.
And in fact, if we don't do that, we're going to plateau at a certain point, because there's certain nuances to the movement that we are missing because we're trying to gloss over the basics. We're trying to skip over it. And we're like, ooh, progress, progress, progress. Think of like crow pose, for example, right? You can make the shape of crow pose, or you can learn how to activate certain muscles in your body in a way that crow pose is one way to facilitate that. And the people who go beyond crow, right, the people who learn, I'm not one of them, who learn how to like press from crow into handstand, those are not people who are like, oh, the version of crow where I'm not lifting my feet is too easy. Those are people who have learned through the more regressed versions how to activate certain muscles in a very coordinated way that allows the progression beyond.
Exactly. So there are the building block concept we can apply in a slightly different way than what we've talked about so far, which this is a great example, crow pose. Let's think about this challenging pose and what all is involved with this. And we can break it apart and focus on being able to activate those key muscle groups that then we can put all that together into this new shape. And we know how to find our deep abdominals. We know how to find our chest muscles. We've played around with our balance, you know, sense of balance and all the components of that posture that are available to us separately would be just, that's another way to break apart any posture. And so we can basically say, hey, when we're doing a subtle kind of deep abdominal activating practice, say with our breath or just lying down and tuning in to your transversus abdominis, for example, we could say to our class, hey, this is prep for crow pose. I was doing a movement earlier with someone today. We were doing this lying down on our backs with just taking a little weight back and forth to practice pulling, this pulling motion to activate latissimus dorsi, which does that pulling down motion. And I said to her, this is actually a prep for a pull-up. You might not feel it that way, but that's exactly what we're doing, right? So it's cool to just think about, okay, what does this skill or this ability to connect with this one muscle group prepare me for down the road?
And on a practical level, one thing that I recommend to yoga teachers who are struggling with regression is to find opportunities to work with people one-on-one, because you take away the complexity of how do I help everybody in the room at the same time, and you narrow it down to, well, what does this person need? And then once you've worked with a lot of different bodies one-on-one, then you can start to much more naturally extrapolate that to a group, where you'll start to see categories of people, right? The category of the person with a lot of strength but limited range of motion, somebody with very extreme range of motion but limited body awareness, et cetera, right? You have just these categories of people, but to try to learn how to help them all at the same time is overwhelming. It is a complicated skill set, and it's much more doable when you just have one person in front of you. And the question you need to ask yourself is, what does this person need?
Yeah, it's true. You know, so practicing on friends and family is a great place to do that too, to kind of build some those categories in your mind. Like, how would I approach this type of person, you know, at this level of their experience and all of that? I'm wondering if we should think about some other specific examples.
That's a good idea. Yeah. I like Warrior Three.
Yeah, Warrior Three is a great example. A posture we can think about that's pretty complicated, lots going on, and we can think about how to approach it from different orientations in gravity, and also how can we prepare the body to handle Warrior Three if we wanted to work on the muscles that are involved, let's say. So Warrior Three is going to involve a lot of balance. Number one, we're on one leg, so that's a challenge already. And it's also going to involve a lot of stability from our hip muscles. Anytime we're on one leg, it's going to require that. But we need to really think, what muscles are in charge of Warrior Three? Who is active? And this is where it can get a little tricky. So if you think about, I'm standing on my right leg, and I have my left leg is back behind me, and my torso is leaning forward, and I'm in the Warrior Three position. The position of my standing leg is hip flexion, right? That's the position it's in. But the muscles that are holding me there and resisting gravity are my hip extensors, my gluteus maximus, and my hamstrings. Those are who's really in charge of this movement. It's just like a single leg deadlift. And they are the muscles that are working here. So if I have a limitation in my strength and I'm not able to really manage this posture, those are the muscles I want to get on board to help them be stronger so that they can do this posture, right? So then I can think about, okay, well, what are some other postures that involve the hip extensors? And let me practice those. Maybe there are some more accessible ones available to me. So then I go through my mental Rolodex and I'm like, huh, what are some other hip extension postures? Okay, I've got two favorites. They are bridge pose and locust pose. Both of them, well, bridge pose certainly is going to be more accessible than a warrior three, right? We've got 2 feet on the ground. As long as we can get to the floor, most people can accommodate that position. Locust pose might be a little bit more challenging just because sometimes it's harder to get in the prone position on our bellies. But in both cases, we have an opportunity to work on that movement of hip extension and use those muscles and learn to feel and connect to those muscles that produce hip extension and know that, okay, when I go back to warrior three, I want to tune into my butt and my hamstrings. Those are the muscles that are really doing this movement. And the muscle that's really stabilizing me in a single leg balancing situation is my lateral hip gluteus medius. So maybe I'm going to also work on more accessible ways for me to connect to that muscle as well so that it's on board when I get back to warrior three. So those are some ways to pick apart what muscles are we targeting here. And then another way to do it is let's change the orientation to gravity. Okay, so we could be in that same shape of warrior three, but I could be on my back instead of standing on my foot, right? So I could just lie down and have one leg up towards the sky. Boom, warrior three, upside down, right? So I can get familiar with the shape of it that way and get familiar, just kind of get comfortable with it. But it's unloaded completely. It's completely different, totally different muscles working in that scenario.
Or you could add support, putting blocks under your hands or putting that back foot against the wall. Those are ways to moderate the effects of gravity, right? When you have limbs far from the ground, just hanging in space, that's a lot of work, right? There's a lot of load from gravity. But as soon as you connect that limb to something connected to the floor, basically, right? The wall is connected to the floor. That's why it's helpful. If it wasn't connected to the floor and it was just waving in space, it wouldn't be helpful. So something connected to the floor, now it's basically like you have brought the floor to you in a way. But you can moderate how much you're using it by how much you're pushing into the prop or the wall. So for example, let's say you have your hands on blocks. You could be like leaning all of your weight into the blocks, or you could be barely touching the blocks and just kind of gently pressing down for a little bit of feedback and a little bit of support.
Yeah, absolutely. You could have hands in a chair as well. And, you know, I focused on the work of the standing leg in Warrior Three, but then we didn't really talk about the leg that's lifted up behind us, which is also, it's in a different position. It's a neutral hip position. It's more extended. It's not flexed. And same muscles are lifting it, actually. The hip extensors are lifting it up. So we've got work going on both legs. And we could, you know, one way we could back down the complexity of that is just to leave that back foot down on the ground. So that now we're kind of in a cross between warrior one and warrior three. But we don't really have to bring that back leg up until we're ready to. And so I like this idea of being on the way to a pose. That's another way of conceptualizing this. How can we be on the way to a certain posture that we're familiar with, a certain shape we're familiar with? How do we get there? And it turns out we can actually stop anywhere along the way and work there. Mm-hmm. And that's why I really like to think about movements instead of fixed postures. Because when we step back and think about movements, we've got all this freedom to be on the way to a shape and on the way back from a shape and so much more to explore. And that's where the progression, you know, and regression can happen.
Yeah, it also requires less stamina to be moving in and out of a shape versus going to like the most extreme version and then holding it there. I think a really nice approach is even when you are planning to hold a static shape, to first move in and out a few times and then invite freedom for your students to decide where along that trajectory they want to pause and hold for a bit. So it might be at the most resting spot. It might be halfway there where they really feel that they can control the movement and be very present in their bodies. Or a lot of people do like to go to that most extreme edge, and that's okay too, especially when they've been given the agency to choose it.
Yeah, definitely. I think our language as teachers really must convey the reality that all these different versions on the same theme have equal value. All the different ways we could modify Warrior 3, they're all just versions of Warrior 3. There's not like a better way to do it and a remedial way to do it. We learn something different in each version, and so they really do have equal value as far as our yoga practice goes. And as long as students are learning that, then now they really will feel more free to choose a place to be that really feels comfortable for them.
Yeah. And I think it's important to recognize as teachers that we are, when we're sending that kind of a message, we are fighting cultural messages that are very deeply ingrained. So it's important also to hold our attachment to the students receiving our message a bit loosely, to know that our responsibility and our work is to express that and to mean it and to demonstrate it, and also not to get down if our students are like always pushing for the most challenging version of a pose. Like, that's a message that they've been given for their entire lives, and it's not necessarily going to be possible for us in our role as yoga teacher to undo that message. The best we can do is make sure we're not reinforcing that message.
Yeah, definitely. Offer a different way of conceptualizing asana and repeat it over and over and mean it. And, you know, then people have an opportunity to develop a different relationship with asana and with their own bodies and with nuance and all the different things that they may discover when they start to explore the in-between places and the variations on these shapes.
Are there any other shapes that are really good examples of poses that we can pull apart and examine from different angles? Maybe triangle?
Yeah, I was just thinking triangle pose. You're reading my mind. There's a lot going on in triangle pose. Mm-hmm. You know, if we think about the components, we have a wide stance, so we have some hip abduction going on. We also have some lateral flexion of the spine, and we have a little bit of rotation of the spine. And depending on what we want to do with our arms and our head, we've got that layer as well. And we're standing upright and we're in triangle pose and we've bent over to the side. We are definitely against gravity. Gravity is pushing our torso down towards the ground, and we're holding it up with our muscles, or we're propped up on a block or some other prop. So depending on whether we're using props or leaning our hand on something, we're going to be working muscles more or less. So we can start to take apart those pieces. We can work on lateral flexion without being in gravity. We can just sit and bend sideways and get the spine warmed up that way. We can do some twisting so that we're familiar with that sort of upper body component of triangle pose. We can do some lateral flexion with a little bit of twisting up towards the sky, which is what we're going to do when we arrive in our triangle pose. So that's worthwhile to practice. We can certainly get comfortable with a wider stance and work on, you know, our legs getting into that position. We don't have to go super wide. We can, but it's just we're in a hip abduction stance. So we can do that sitting down on the ground. We can do that lying down on the ground. And then we could, of course, do that standing up. I really like a lying down triangle pose. I think that's a fabulous way to start a triangle pose. It's a little game. Like, can you reproduce that posture lying down on your back? Like, how interesting, you know? It's a little bit of a teaser. And anytime we practice the same thing in a novel way, we're giving our brain this great opportunity to learn more about the body with more clarity in our body maps that live in the brain. So it's really actually great practice. The brain loves novelty. Doing the same thing in different ways, doing different things in the same ways, you know, like just mixing it up like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's a great skill as a teacher to be able to bring different angles to the same exercises. Our bodies are so complex and yoga is so multifaceted that in a way you can never do the same practice twice. When you're first starting to teach, it's probably more beneficial to have a basic template or a few basic templates of practices that you teach again and again, but in different ways, versus feeling this pressure to like have a fresh sequence and like be super creative every time. Here is the truth. A good teacher does not need to use different poses to be creative. Mm-hmm. They don't need to link unexpected poses together to be creative. Your creativity is the spark of your desire to help people, the people in your class, and your ability to express that in a novel way. So I just want to throw that out there as an invitation to let go of any external pressure that you might be feeling to have a creative sequence, quote unquote. To know that if your relationship to the sequence, your relationship to the asanas you're choosing and the practices you're choosing, that is what's going to keep it fresh and creative. It's not about the external shape of what you're doing. It's really about the approach.
Yeah, I really agree. As you were just talking about that, I was thinking, gosh, wouldn't it be so cool to create just a little basic standing posture sequence, postures that are just classic, you know, the warriors and triangle and side angle, but to do them all in a supine position first. How fun would, I've never done that, but how fun would that be to just get into these shapes? We can, you know, lie on our side and do warrior one, warrior two, and stick our leg up for warrior three, and then we could do a triangle pose and side angle and just play around with these and get our bodies warmed up in that way and get our brains warmed up and tuned into our bodies. And then that, you know, it's a great way to prep for an actual standing pose sequence, whether it's in the same class or the following week. But I really like that idea of it doesn't have to be fancy to be creative. It just has to be novel, you know?
Yeah, I love that idea. And I hope that if you're listening, that this conversation is inspiring you to experiment in your own practice and in your own classes with ways to present these asanas in a way that is about helping students achieve a specific experience versus expressing a format, like a fitness format that you learned from the outside. If you approach it that way, then it accommodating and supporting students of varying physical abilities is going to start to come together for you in a way that is really rewarding and fulfilling and actually doesn't feel that hard, feels creative and intuitive.
I totally agree. I think that if teachers can keep exactly that in mind, that these asanas are just here as tools to help us have an experience. And so when we're teaching them in our class, our goal is to create an experience for the student. And we can do that in so many ways. So if we know, like, what's the feeling that this posture gives me? Okay, I want to create that in a different way now for the student who maybe needs a different modification. Then it becomes less stressful, I think, and more inspired. And yeah, like you said, more meaningful, really, to think of it that way. These aren't performance things. This is not, you know, an acrobatic performance. This is an inner experience that we're cultivating for our students. We're hoping to. Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the building blocks to being able to do this through our bodies, there's lots of different aspects to yoga. There's pranayama, there's meditation, there's bhakti, there's service, there's all different aspects to yoga. But if you're primarily an asana teacher, then the basic building block is understanding the human body and studying some anatomy. And Libby has a really amazing membership called Anatomy Bites that was designed especially to support yoga teachers, especially if you don't have a background in anatomy already, to learn the aspects of anatomy that are most relevant for teaching yoga and to learn them in a yoga context where you can then also have practices that she includes. So she'll teach like a little conceptual piece, and then you'll put it into a practice. You'll move your body and you'll explore it in your own body. So the website for that is anatomybites.com if that sounds like something that would be interesting for you.
So this is exactly why I created Anatomy Bites, is that just like all other new yoga teachers, I had the same experience when I first came out of teacher training. And I know there's a lot of intimidation around anatomy. And so I was really wanting to create an opportunity to study anatomy that is fun. You know, we don't need to take ourselves so seriously. And so, but to have some support and a community around it has just been really great. So I hope people will check out anatomybites.com if you're inclined.
And if this is your first time hearing Libby, there's a whole bunch of other podcast episodes that I'll link to in the show notes. Libby and I met in teacher training in 19... when was it?
It was 2004.
2004.
It was 20 years ago.
That means it was 20 years ago.
It was 20 years ago. Yeah.
Okay. So we met in teacher training 20 years ago, and Libby ended up going to physical therapy school, became a practicing physical therapist, and then even went back to school and got her doctorate in physical therapy. So she's such a great person to learn anatomy from because she remembers what it was like to be a yoga teacher who did not have an anatomy background. And then she went back and she got that knowledge and that information. So she's really great at integrating these two bodies of knowledge, yoga and anatomy. And what I really love about her approach is it's not about teaching anatomy in your classes. It's about having anatomy as the foundation beneath you so that you actually don't have to talk about it as much. It's just informing your choices, and it's giving you a lot of confidence in those choices.
Absolutely. It's like in your back pocket. It's like your little kind of blankie in your back pocket. It's just providing a sense of confidence, and then you know when you speak about the body, you're more clear, you're more accurate. The anatomy understanding is informing your sequencing. It's helping you understand why you do what you do. It's really important to have that in the background, even if you don't want to teach your students about anatomy. Now, some do and some don't, but I don't think that's why it's ultimately really important.
Agree. So if anyone listening wants to find out more about you other than Anatomy Bites, where should they go?
So you can find me on Instagram at Libby Hinesley PT, and also my website, which is LibbyHinesley.com. And from that website, you can get to Anatomy Bites, and you can get to my book and hypermobility stuff, and it'll take you all over the place.
Awesome. As always, Libby, thank you so much for this chat and for the awesome work you do helping yoga teachers feel confident in their knowledge about the body.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for all that you do as well, Mado.
20 years of friendship.
That's right. Cheers to 20 more.
I think it'll be 20 years in the fall. We started in the fall, right?
Or did I think you're right. I think we did start. We started September, maybe.
Mm-hmm. All right. 20. We'll have to celebrate, do something special.
Yeah, absolutely.